to order. Welcome all to the August 21st meeting of the Central Marin Sanitation Commission. Would you all please join me in the Pledge of Allegiance?
Pledge of Allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Kate, would you please call the roll?
Certainly. Diane Burst.
Here.
Dean DiGiovanni.
Here.
Michael Borstein.
Here.
Doug Kelly.
Here.
And Dan Hilmer.
Here.
Thank you. First up on the agenda is open time for public participation. This is the time we set aside for any member of the public to speak on anything not on tonight's agenda. Is there any member of the public who would like to speak? Seeing none, we will move on to the consent calendar. The purpose of the consent calendar is to consider routine actions that will be enacted by one motion. Any member of the public, staff, or the Board of Commissioners may remove an item if they would like further discussion. Is there anybody who would like to remove an item? Seeing none, I will entertain a motion to approve 4A through 4H.
So moved.
Second.
Thank you. There's a motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Any?
Yeah.
Okay. Any abstentions?
I mentioned just that we have a new...
I should mention that. You're right. Would you like to?
We have a new member of the commission here from Ross Valley Sanitary District, Doug Kelly, who was selected by our board last month.
I've been a backup, and I've come to a bunch of meetings, as you know, for the joint powers, so I'm pleased to be here. I wanted to be on it, so I'm very happy. I also wanted to note that one of the things I bring to our board, and I think this one is my ability to change my mind on issues. So prior to that, I was perfectly fine with our self-imposed two-year limit for service to this board. But I immediately changed my mind upon being put on the board. Central Marin, I said, Ross Valley no longer has a self-imposed limit for 2 years.
Attaboy. All right. And I also mentioned that that's... this is Doug's first time. That's why it's a special meeting.
Very good.
Very special meeting.
Well, welcome, Doug, even though you seem old hat. We've seen you around on as an alternate and on the ad hoc for the JPA. So
thank you very much.
Nice to see you on here semi-permanently. Let's go ahead and move on to agenda item number 5. Agenda Facilities Master Plan Presentation. Jason, would you like to introduce this?
Sure. I have a little bit of background information for you. So this was a pretty important project for the agency, and this was developed during the summer of 2016, and the contract with Kroll Engineers was awarded by the board in September 2016. And there was a pretty accelerated and aggressive, you know, schedule for the master plan, which is comprised of 10 different specific tasks. And the schedule was driven by primarily two factors. One was we needed to have a blending alternative selected in December, so we could in December 16, so we could have it included in a report of waste discharge to the Regional Water Board in January 17. And then also our member agency managers were talking about the potential to go through a Prop 218 rate increase process in the spring of 2017. So we knew that if we wanted to, you know, take any of the plan-level information from the master plan work, we'd have to talk with the finance committee, select projects, include that into the CIP, into a revenue plan, then get the operating capital information or revenue needs from the agency to the members to include in their Prop 218, you know, notices to the property owners and their rates. So there was 10 tasks that needed to get done in a pretty short period of time, but we had a pretty good schedule and a plan laid out to do that. And the work went forward pretty well. You know, the board made a decision on the blending alternative, and that went to the Regional Water Board. As you know, that was accepted and included in our 2018 NPS permit, which was great news for the agency. But then there were a couple developments that allowed the schedule to relax. One was that the member agency board decided they weren't going to go through with the Prop 218 rate adjustment process that spring, or even this last spring. And then second, that in September of 16, CMSA submitted an application to the State Water Resource Control Board Florida State Revolving Fund loan under the Green Project Reserve category. And what we did for the project that we included in that application was bundle together projects from our PG interconnection agreement work and several of the tasks from the master plan. So that became this project that was approved by, well, that we submitted to the Water Board. And it took a year for them to approve the project. And we weren't sure that if we started some of these master plan tasks that were in that project, that we'd get retroactive reimbursement for the costs associated with those. So we asked Corolla if we could hold off initiating these until we received approval from the Regional Water Board. And they said that was fine. So we, expanded the duration of the contract for about a year. And here we are today. So during that year time period that, we extended the contract duration, I gave the board updates, status reports, or even, formal presentations on several of the tasks in the master plan, like the sea level rise, solar power feasibility, dewatering alternative analysis, and decisions either were made to include some things in the CIP or not. And then for the tasks, the board hasn't been briefed on, and those were initiated early, late last year, and they're pretty much wrapped up. And that's really kind of the focus of tonight's discussion. So when we scoped out the presentation, I talked with Elizabeth and Rick, and we agreed, well, how about we'll just give the board just really high-level scope and findings from those tasks that you already reported on. We'll spend a little more detail on the four other tasks. So that PowerPoint presentation is included in the staff report, and Rick Chan and Elizabeth Charbonnet are here to present it. So with that, I'll turn it over to my good friends from Corolla.
Okay. Thank you, Dixon. Great. Thanks for having me here to make this presentation. And feel free to ask questions as I go or at the end, wherever works best for you. It's fine with me.
Hi, Beth.
So, hi. How are you? Okay. So, like Jason mentioned, our scope on this project was to complete 10 separate evaluations of various areas for the plant, and out of those 10 items, we can really group them into or divide them into four categories. Some are related to liquid stream treatment, some are related to solid stream treatment, some are related to energy management, and then the rest being kind of plant-wide issues. And then to drill down on that a little bit, so in terms of the liquid treatment, there are three evaluations, or TMs, we call them TMs because that's the deliverable technical memorandum. They're related to the water side, or the liquid side, three related to the solid side, two on the energy side, and then two on plant-wide issues, as I shown up there. And then, like Jason mentioned, six out of the 10 TMs or evaluations were completed prior to last month, and Jason gave you some presentations on that. I am going to do a quick recap of those six, and then followed by a more detailed explanation or presentation of the other four. So on the liquid stream side, two TMs we completed. One was on blending reduction. The other one was on secondary treatment. So as you can see from the slide, on the blending reduction, basically our scope was to help you guys update the agency's 2011 utility analysis report, and to also look at, are there other alternatives to help reduce or look at the blending reduction alternatives. And we looked at a bunch of different alternatives, one of them also being the no project alternative that was presented to the board. I think Jason did that. And the board selected that particular alternative, which was then presented to the regional board. And good news, like Jason mentioned, was that they accepted that. And then that got implemented into your NPDES permit, really without requiring you guys to spend money to actually make that happen. So that was good news there. Second one is on secondary treatment. Here our job was to do a pretty detailed evaluation of the plant's secondary treatment process, the main process of the plant, to see if there's any optimization strategies or ideas out there, above and beyond what you guys are doing right now. And what we found was that working with the agency staff, basically the current system was operating very well. As a matter of fact, your current operating or dry and wet weather operating modes are actually dialed in pretty nicely to produce very high quality effluent. So there wasn't that much that we could really do to fine tune it. So that confirmed what the agency staff was doing, and that was also good news for you guys. On the solid stream side, one TM was completed, which was the biosolids dewatering. And so here, what we did is that the agency currently uses something called centrifuge to dewater the biosolids, the digestive solids. And so basically, we looked at whether the agency should continue to use the centrifuges or you look at other technologies. We did a pretty detailed comparison, and what we came up with was that we found that the centrifuge alternative, the technology, is still a very good technology for CMSA. So we recommend that the centrifuge technology be continued on. The other thing we found out was that looking at the records of the units that you guys have, looks like it was maintained and operated really well, and that it was not falling apart at the point. So we were able to recommend that, hey, you don't need to replace it right away. You can defer this project for a couple more years. In this case, I think we said 4 years, and then take a look at it again. If it's replacing, then at that time, we'll look into replacing those centrifuges with newer centrifuges, whether they're higher capacity or the same kind of capacity units. So we'll take a second look at that 4 or 5 years from now, if they ever need to do it again. So that was also good news. On the energy management side, one item we looked at was solar power. And so this was to evaluate whether solar photovoltaic system would be applicable at the plant here. And, you know, the analysis showed that, yes, you definitely, you know, the site can support a PV system. However, when a consultant of ours that worked on this looked at the financial aspects of it, the numbers didn't really pencil out in terms of the return on investment. So as a result, no project was included in the CIP for this particular alternative. And then last but not least, the plant-wide issues completed. There are two of them. One is a condition assessment. This is a focus condition assessment done for the whole plant, the major assets that you have at the plant. And the goal there was to look at or evaluate all these major assets to see, evaluate what kind of potential replacement or rehabilitation alternatives are needed to make sure that these units are up in order and that they can keep running for the next 10 to 20 years. And what we did is that we worked closely with plant staff and then worked together and developed a list of these projects. We helped them prioritize them, and then at the end we helped the agency work out the higher ranking ones, the higher priority ones, and that got incorporated into your 10-year CIP that I think you guys are aware of. So, and then the last one was sea level rise. This is, you know, basically, you know, the Marin area, they developed a model that looked at what happens if sea level rises in this area outside, and looking at, you know, various scenarios such as the 100-year flood, 20 years, 50 years from now, what happens. And the idea there was to look at if the sea level rise does happen, how would that impact basically the plant? And also, how does that impact your ability to continue to send flow out to the ocean, to the outfall that you guys have right now? And so what we did is that we took a pretty detailed look at that, and what we found out was that, you know, with the sea level rise, it ranges between somewhere between 4 to 8 feet, potentially out in the water area, and that you know, it would cause some flooding within kind of the city of Marin area, but the way it worked out on the map is that it didn't really affect the plant facilities here, but it does flood a little bit, for example, on Anderson Drive, as an example, but not impacting the facilities. Well, that was good news. And then we also, took a look at how that would potentially impact the discharge capacity to the bay. And there was minimal discharge, not to the point where it actually negatively impacted, but because you have a big pump station here, you're still able to push the water out during that scenario where the sea level is rising. So that was also good news there. And so before I move on, sounds like you have a question.
Yeah, on the sea level rise, with being able to just basically access the plant, that was one of our concerns when Jason had a presentation some time ago, just about the ability to get one staff here to operate it, two is also to get our solids handling trucks out of here to get rid of the solids.
Yep.
And then also just to bring the food waste in and for all of our energy generation activities that we do here, without with I don't see anything like that being addressed in the technical memo, or I didn't say the technical memo, but in this issue.
Okay.
Like how we...
Yeah, the scope of work for this was just, you know, under those different sea level rise events that were derived from the bay wave model. Mm-hmm. You know, was there flooding on CMC property would affect, you know, our infrastructure and assets here, and just the ability to discharge the water that's pumped to us by the satellite agencies. Mm-hmm. We didn't look at other impacts like, you know, flooding on 580, flooding on Anderson Drive, and the important things you just mentioned, how would people get to work, how would chemicals get delivered here, how would biosols get hauled. That wasn't considered in the scope of the TM, but those are real concerns. But in the 25-year CIP that the committee hasn't looked at yet, we have a fleet of boats that were in there. Just kidding.
Or a helicopter.
Either way, right? To get the stuff out of
here.
Or we'll just let the city of San Rafael figure out the rest of it.
Yeah.
But in all seriousness, should we be though thinking that way? Do we need then more on-site storage for all the stuff coming out of the San Rafael?
It's definitely something to think about in the long term if the sea level rise starts to happen and we see, like, say, you know, Caltrans and CSU San Rafael not addressing it by raising up the roadways or getting the water out to. So there are a lot of different things that we'll need to track on as an agency that are under the control of others. Mm-hmm. But those are some good points that we definitely need to figure out what are we going to do in terms of, you know, offloading materials, getting materials here, getting staff on site. But it's way into the future.
Yeah. Another thing we did actually recommend in the TM was to, it needs to be a regional solution because basically it's the road that's flooded out there,
right, not inside
the plant. And so I don't know how much jurisdiction you actually have over the road, but since like the city has to kind of, you have to work with the city.
We know people in the city.
Okay, good. There you go. Yeah, that's exactly what you got to do is start the dialogue there over time because it really needs to be a regional solution. It's not something that you would just go and fix the road, right?
Right. So.
One thing that we didn't look at was, you know, the impact on Sir Francis Drake because it's a lot higher elevation than Anderson. So that could be a route to get here still.
But wouldn't the bigger impact be on SR Sand? Because we're so much lower, we're going to get flooded.
Yeah.
And that's one thing. Raising the pump stations, though, and doing stuff at the pump stations to get the flow there.
Right. So isn't it going to be like a storm? Aren't we going to have a lot of
infiltration?
Well, ionized would increase, but... you're hoping by the time that the tidal influence groundwater got up to a point where it was going to excessively get into the sewer lines, that there was enough rehabilitation to minimize INI. Because all the members do have pretty aggressive, you know, INI reduction programs compared to, say, 10 years ago. But one thing that we talked about at the end of this particular presentation was we need to go out and talk with member agency managers at one of our monthly meetings about what their plans are. So I brought that up, and they said that... it was a short discussion, but they said that they are considering, you know, sea level rise in their, you know, sewer system rehabilitation projects. Okay. And I didn't ask any questions beyond that.
Yeah, that's good. Okay. Anything else on the past TMs that I just briefly recap? If not, then we'll go and talk about today's focus, which is these four TMs, and I'll go to this slide, which basically kind of re-racked the four TMs into two categories. One is liquid treatment, I'll call it advanced treatment that I'll talk about. The other ones would be combining the solids treatment and the energy management because they are related to each other, and Elizabeth will present those. Okay. So this is a neutral removal one. So currently, your plant is basically being regulated by your NPDES permit. And if you look at that permit, it has a table that contains more than just this stuff, but generally it includes a lot of the constituents that are shown here. The one that I wanted to point out here is that the third line down is total ammonia. Okay, so right now your current permit requires or has a requirement of 60 milligrams per liter, which is pretty easy to meet for a lot of the plants without doing a whole lot of separate treatment or anything like that, without any really special treatment to get that. So, but the main focus right now these days is more on right now for this plant is the BLD of the first two lines and the suspended solids. And the reason why I want to bring this up is that, you know, note the 60 milligrams per liter, because what's been discussed out there right now on this line is that working with the regional board, working with BACWA, which is the Bay Area Clean Water Agencies, talking about, hey, you know what, you know, there's been discussions about what if we need to go to neutral removal later on to remove ammonia, potentially phosphorus, and so on. And if so, you know, what would those potential limits be? And so they are working together and came up with kind of a work plan over the last couple of years that I'm sure Jason has already probably talked to you guys about or introduced the topic. And in that proposed work plan that's been going on already, they propose basically three levels of treatment. And generally the ones that affect you guys the most is probably level two, or the most applicable based on where you guys are located at, which is, you know, 2 milligrams per liter of ammonia, 15 milligrams per liter of total nitrogen, and 1 milligram per liter of phosphorus if that were to be implemented. You can remember that earlier you guys are right now required to only get it down to 60. If it turns out this were to come to fruition, you know, we're looking at 60 down to 2. And so you would need more than what you have right now to remove the ammonia, to basically treat the wastewater in addition to what you're doing right now in order to remove the ammonia from 60 down to 2. So it would, you know, require new facilities and so on. And that's really part of this, the charge of this TM, is to look at that, hey, if it were to happen, what would you need? How much would it cost? So that's what this TM is kind of looking at, the kind of what-if scenario right there. And so then this slide, what I wanted to talk about was kind of like our crystal ball look at, you know, when's going to happen? It's not going to be tomorrow. Is it going to be 100 years from now? What's happening is that, so right now we are, you know, obviously in 2018. Let's see if this pointer works. Okay, good. And so the last couple of years, there's been a lot of studies going on to basically try to better understand, you know, how much nutrient removal do we really need to do in order to kind of, you know, not impair the bay so much. And so you'll see a lot of studies going on, or you hear a lot of studies going on, but realistically, talking to the regulators and so on, we're looking at somewhere in the 2024, 2029 range for anything to happen, if they were to happen in that time frame. So there's probably a 5 to 10 year window before, you know, anything would, you know, before the ammonia requirement would drop from 60 to 2, if it turns out that is needed. Okay, so that's the kind of time frame we're looking at. Let's see, sorry.
May I ask a quick question?
Yeah.
By what mechanism are those kinds of things removed? The nitrogen, the ammonia.
You mean the treatment processes?
Yeah.
I'll go over that.
Okay.
In the in one of the future slides, and I'll talk.
New either 3 or 2 facilities to be built.
I'm sorry.
Yeah,
it's coming up. You looked ahead already. So, yeah, exactly. So this is almost like a recap of the previous slide. It talks about the compliance for low caps expected between, like I mentioned, 2029 and 2034. So we're talking about, you know, 10 plus years away. And like I mentioned, for where you guys are discharging to, in kind of the central San Francisco Bay area, I mentioned there's 3 levels, but level 2 is most likely, if you're going to do anything, that's where you're going to land. So what our charge on this TM was to do was to try to figure out, going from where you guys are at to meet the level 2 requirement. I did put on the third bullet, you know, we in the back of our mind, we did want to make sure that whatever we put in can easily be expanded to go to level 3 if it turns out you need to go there 10 years from now or 15 years from now. So it's just kind of an add-on. But the focus was really looking at target level 2 right now, okay? And so this is, I just want to give you a quick recap. This is your existing treatment facility, a flow diagram, moving from left to right. You know, you got your preliminary treatment with the grid tanks, you got your primary treatment, you currently use bio towers and aeration basins, and secondary, clarifies as your secondary treatment facilities, then it gets chlorinated before it gets discharged to the bay. So what we did on this particular TM was that we looked at basically many treatment alternatives were evaluated to meet these limits. These include what we call side stream treatment processes shown here. Well, the whole point here was to focus on like a concentrated stream of, say, ammonia. The thinking behind that was that, you know, we try to go after where the major loads are, remove that, and then that will potentially see if we can meet the requirements just through that side stream treatment. Second thing was that we would look at whether we should, you know, potentially continue to use the bow towers or not, or abandon them, depending on the process that we end up doing. We also looked at, hey, maybe there's an opportunity to kind of rework your mainstream treatment process with, you know, three or four processes that are commonly used out there in the industry right now. MLE, BioMag, IFAS, if we go into those a little bit more later, if there's questions about what they look like. And then if that doesn't work out, or if additional facilities are needed, maybe what we can do is what we do call parallel treatment. That is, pull a small stream out of here, treat it, really get it down to a really low number, and then blend it back in order to meet that 2 mg/L permit. So, you know, common processes used is membrane bioreactors. These are being used right now over in Richmond, and then, or West County, Richmond, and then a more innovative process called aerobic granular sludge reactors. This is actually being tested right now over at a place, Loma, over in San Lorenzo. So we did, like I said, a lot of different iterations, and for today, I just wanted to show one possible treatment alternative that we believe would work well is shown here, and this includes basically not needing the usual bio towers, but maybe even potentially reuse that for something else later. But the main focus would be that use a mainstream treatment process, basically rework the aeration basins and the clarifiers, optimize them, add in this parallel treatment stream that I've shown here using the membrane bioreactor process. And this, based on our modeling and our evaluations, will be able to meet the level 2 requirements of ammonia and nitrogen that I talked about earlier. And, you know, preliminary costs for something like this is about $35 million in project costs, just to give you an idea of the magnitude that we're looking at. And here, just to show you that we also, our charge was to say, well, we came up with the treatment process, was it going to fit? And so this site layout basically shows how, what it would potentially look like. So the blue facilities are, let's see, the blue facilities here are basically retrofits or modifications of existing facilities. I mentioned the existing mainstream treatment process and also the clarifiers. The green facilities, they're the new facilities. Basically, you know, one possible location is on that parking lot area in the back here. And this is the bioreactor that the what I call the parallel treatment stream, the parallel treatment facilities with the membrane bioreactors on the top here. So with these facilities, I'm pretty confident that that will meet the level 2 requirements at the $35 million price tag. That's at today's dollars. And obviously, you know, as technology advances, these costs might go down over time. But for now, I mean, this is kind of our best cut at it. So, yeah.
What exactly is the stripping process for ammonia, phosphorus, and nitrogen? The bio tower, you're trickling water down it, with the bugs acting on it, and getting air and everything. What does the bioreactor do?
Basically, it's really like a high rate. Currently, you have what you call an activated sludge process, and it's just a biological process. These are also biological processes. Also, they're just a little higher rate with different bacterias that are basically set up to target ammonia. In addition to, say, the VOD and the TSS, that's all. But it's all still a biological treatment process.
So you just plant special bugs?
Basically what you do is you configure the basins so you culture a certain type of bugs. You know, any constituents that are out there, there's going to be a bug or two that will be able to degrade it, biodegrade it. Mm-hmm. So anytime you have these things, what you're trying to do is culture a certain kind of bacteria, and sometimes their growth rate is really what you're trying to target. Mm-hmm. Some bugs grow faster, some bugs grow slower. And so for the ammonia bacteria, the ammonia bugs, they grow a little bit slower. So you need bigger tanks, you need to be able to have more facilities in order to kind of culture them so they can then do their work and remove the constituent of concern. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So.
How do the operating and maintenance costs of this kind of a setup compare to our current method of treatment?
Yeah, so basically, generally speaking, the processes are about the same in terms of operation. In terms of the O&M cost, it requires more oxygen for these to work. when you remove basically the current removal of BLD, mm-hmm. it requires, like, if you say this amount of oxygen for when you try to remove ammonia, you got to have this much more. So the O&M cost is going to be primarily on power on that. But labor-wise, it's just a little bit minimal cost, but it's really the power cost for the additional air that you need in order to remove the ammonia.
And the membranes are not overly expensive to maintain and replace those as needed?
Well, I mean, expensive is a subjective word, but, you basically have no choice. And if you have to go remove ammonia, mm-hmm. Let the membrane biobreakers is a really cost-effective process that can do that. They're being widely used all over the world. Okay. Right now, everyone could look at one. There's one in Modesto, California, that's using it right now.
Okay,
so,
thanks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Modesto, they're right. They're
right. Google Earth.
yeah. There's some in Europe too, so that's a better trip, so we can make that happen. But I think that concludes my portion. If there are no more questions, I'm going to turn over to my colleague, Elizabeth. Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rick. Make sure I can work this. Okay. So before I get into the details of the last three memos that I'm going to talk about that are all on solids and energy management, I just want to provide you guys with a little bit of background on your current solids operation, just as a quick refresher. So starting on the left, we have all the solids inputs that go into the digester. You have your more traditional primary sludge and thickened waste-activated sludge that go directly into the digester, and then CMSA also has an organic waste receiving station that accepts high-strength waste, like fats, oils, and grease, or fog, as well as food waste. Both of those types of high-strength waste get sent to CMSA's organic waste receiving station, where they're mixed and then pumped to the digester, along with your primary sludge and your thickened waste-activated sludge. From there, sludge is digested, biosolids come out, and they're dewatered, and they're sent off-site to one of the three locations shown on the bottom right here. If we switch gears and talk about the biogas that's coming out of the digester, that biogas is treated to remove a number of contaminants before it's then either used in CMSA's boiler to produce heat or in CMSA's cogeneration engine to produce electricity. Now, the reason I wanted to walk through this is just to highlight the three memos that I'm going to be talking about really focus on three different portions of this process. So again, starting in the bottom left with the material coming into your digester, I'm really focusing on the organic waste receiving station and how it's currently sized, and options to potentially increase the size of that if you want to expand your fog and food waste program. Then I'll go into the other side, so the solids coming out of the digester. I'm going to talk about where you currently send your biosolids and options for maybe changing that up depending on regulations currently and how they may change in the future. Then finally, I'm going to switch gears and talk about the biogas, so the system with all the black arrows, and talk about how you might want to expand that in the future. And so as I go through all of this, I just want to sort of put it into context for you. Really, the outcome and the results of each of these memos really depend on how much energy CMSA wants to generate. And so we looked at sort of three different scenarios that each generate a little bit different amount of energy. So the first scenario that we looked at is plant self-sufficiency, and that would require generating about 650 kilowatts of power. If you want to take it a step further and maximize your existing cogeneration capacity, that would require about 750 kilowatts of power. And finally, if you want to go all the way and maximize your existing digester capacity and produce as much power on site as possible, you could produce about 1,500 kilowatts of power. So I'm just going to come back to these three scenarios as I walk through the three memos, just to provide you some context. Does anyone have any questions right now before I move on, dive into the memos?
No.
Okay, cool. All right, so the first memo that I want to talk about is the organic waste receiving station. And again, coming back to these three scenarios shown on the top here, any one of these three scenarios, to produce more energy on site, you need to increase the amount of feedstock coming into your digester. So in any one of these cases, the amount of fog and food waste coming to your site is going to increase anywhere from 26% with the first scenario all the way up to 260%, or about five times as much food waste and fog as you accept now.
And there can be other types of organic materials, too.
Yes, yeah.
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
When we look at expanding the program, once we have our interconnection, you know, approved by PG&E, we're going to reach out to a lot of the types of, you know, facilities that produce other types of organic materials too, cheeseways, breweries, wineries, and other things. So it could be a lot different than this too in terms of volatile organic content. And these numbers too, those are a little older. So like these numbers now are probably higher than they are currently, as is shown on the slide.
Yeah, this is based on fiscal year 16-17, so I'm sure the amount of fog and food waste except right now has increased a little bit. And like Jason said, we looked really at just fog and food waste and the volatile solids loading for those types of materials. So the volume of other types of organic waste that you send to your digesters may be different if you have different volatile solids loading with a different waste stream. So given that, we looked at around four different alternatives for expanding your existing organic waste receiving facility. So right now, CMSA has one below-grade tank. And the first two alternatives that we looked at would just be to double that existing storage capacity. Alternative one is just expanding that entirely below grade, so just mirror imaging what you're doing now and just doubling that. Alternative two would sort of break it up a little bit and provide additional storage above grade and separate out your fog and your food waste receiving. But again, all of that material then gets sent to the digester. If we want to fine-tune it a little bit and provide a slightly smaller option, we looked at storage for a one-day hydraulic residence time. So basically, you're filling and you're emptying your tank each day. And again, the alternative on the left is entirely below grade. And alternative four is a mix of below grade and above grade storage. So given these four alternatives, we determined that alternative three, which was the smaller, entirely below grade storage tank, was preferred. First of all, because it has the lowest project cost at around $1.2 million. And it also has the smallest footprint and it's entirely below ground. And finally, it's familiar staff. It's just an expansion of the current system, and so it doesn't require a lot of relearning of new systems. Any questions on that memo before I switch gear to a different type of solid? Okay.
Well, yeah. I have a quick question. Let's say we went to the third scenario, which is, you know, maximizing the output based on the digester size.
Right.
Is a one-day expansion enough?
So these scenarios, these alternatives are based on providing a one-day expansion for scenario two. So you would need to expand a little bit more than what's shown in these alternatives if you wanted to go all the way to scenario three.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
But, I mean, the one-day concept should work for your facility. It's just depends on how much volume you want to take in each day to size that tank.
Okay. It's likely, too, operationally, we would try to schedule different types of loads throughout the day. So we'd batch load in the morning different materials, send it to the digester for 6 hours. Then we'd bring in material in the afternoon in a different batch load to send it. Instead of just like one operation, we have two operations. And that helps, you know, minimize the amount of underground storage or above ground storage we need.
Right.
And are those companies that are delivering, are they open to honoring that kind of a schedule request?
We haven't talked to them about that because we consider it's too premature right now.
Okay.
Pardon me?
Is that Marin Sanitary collecting those?
They collect just the food waste.
And fog.
They don't collect any fog.
They don't fog.
Just the food waste, and they're on a set schedule. They bring that in the morning.
Okay.
So it'd be other types of liquid waste that we'd try to schedule potentially in the future. In the afternoon, if we had so much material coming in under the first batch load that we couldn't accept it with the current storage or one of these one-day HRT, you know, storages options.
What are the costs of the expansion to the third scenario?
We'd have to look at that a little bit more, but I think it would be closer to one of the alternative one or two, where you're doubling the above grade storage or the below grade storage tank, and that would be more instead of a 1.5 day hydraulic residence time, it'd be closer to a 1 day hydraulic residence time to get to scenario three. If that makes sense. All right. Okay. So moving on from the solids that are going into the digester to the biosolids that are coming out of the digester. Again, sort of want to come back to these three scenarios that we've been talking about with how much energy CMSA wants to produce. And to produce any additional energy, you're going to be putting more material in, so you're going to be getting more solids out. And that can range anywhere from 3 to 24% with the three scenarios that we're showing here. Now, this slide has a lot going on, and I'm not going to go through everything on here. I know you guys all have hard copies, but this is more just for your reference. But I just wanted to note that there are a lot of regulatory drivers that are impacting where it makes sense to send biosolids and use them after they leave the treatment plant. And there are two key points that I want you to take away. The first, on the left, there's a lot of these regulations that are really trying to get organics and other materials out of landfills. And right now, CMSA sends the majority of your biosolids to landfills in the wintertime, and so that's going to become harder and harder to do as these regulations get implemented. And the other key point that I want you to take away, if you look at the right-hand side of the slide here, this map shows all the land application regulations, and right now CMSA sends the majority of their biosolids to land application in the summertime. And what we've seen trends over time is that this is becoming more and more restrictive. And right now CMSA produces a Class B biosolid, and so right now you can only land apply that in the five green counties. So it's greatly restricted. So CMSA is not only it's not only becoming more difficult to landfill in the wintertime, but it's also becoming more difficult to land apply in the summertime.
Can we also send it to the blue where there's no regulations?
So there's potential there. It really is. It really is county by county. And I think in those areas, like if there's not a lot of land in Alameda or Santa Clara, so a lot of those is there's just not a lot of land to do anything, so no one's really tested that. And I know some counties or some folks are trying to overturn some of these county bans, so there is a lot of movement, but it is sort of a hot topic right now, and it's a little uncertain how much land is really going to be available in the future, and if people are getting kicked out of landfills, there's more material that folks want to land apply. Say what?
So is Nevada.
Yeah. And then can you quickly describe what Class B means and what the other classes are?
Yeah, so there's no class, right? So just biosolids, that's sort of the lowest level. Then there's Class B, which has a certain amount of pathogen reduction and a certain amount of metals limits and whatnot. And then there's Class A, which is held to a slightly higher standard. And then there's Class AEQ, and that's even higher still. And these are federal standards. It's based on 503 regs and EPA. And it really depends. It's like it's a temperature and a time spent in the digester, if that makes sense.
Would we be in a better position if we upgraded, say, from Class B to Class A? And is that...
We looked at that in this memo. Right now, the processes to convert your biosolids to Class A are really expensive, and given the options that are still available in the next 5 to 10 years, I'm not sure that it makes sense. And I know there is a lot of work being done trying to open some of this land to Class B, because there is a value of keeping a lot of that moisture in the biosolids, because as you go from Class B to Class A and to Class AEQ, it tends to get drier.
Yes, thank you.
My two cents. Okay. So given all of those changing regulations, I just wanted to point out some options for where folks can send biosolids in the future. Now, the first three are things that CMSA are currently doing. There's land application. Right now, you're land applying with Synagro in the summer. There's the potential to expand that in the wintertime and do that in Sacramento, and Synagro has quoted a price for CMSA to do that, slightly higher. Right now, you're also sending biosolids to landfill. It's one of the cheaper options. But again, moving forward in the future, it's really unknown how much that's going to cost and if that's really going to be an option. Finally, CMSA also sends biosolids to LISTEC, which is a regional facility in Fairfield Sassoon. It's a higher price, but it does help diversify CMSA's biosolid portfolio at this point in time. And two other options that we looked at. Was first composting, and that again can be done year-round for a little higher price. And the fifth and final option that we looked at was a regional facility through the Bay Area Biosolids Coalition. And right now you see that there's quite a range in costs for that regional facility, and they're really trying to dial that in over the next year or so. So it's worth keeping an eye on.
And where is composting? Can composting be done here?
Composting requires a fair amount of land, so I don't know that you could do it on your site right here. I think the prices that are quoted for this would be to send your biosolids through Synagro to a facility down in Merced, where they have an existing compost site. But I know the Bay Area Biosolids Coalition is also looking at potentially doing a new compost facility through their organization. So. All right. So given those regulatory drivers and the changing costs, this is our recommendation moving forward. So in the summertime, it makes sense to continue land application. It is the cheapest option right now. But we expect that land application costs are going to increase over time. And when they get to about $60 per wet ton, then it starts to make sense to look at other options, like increasing the amount sent to a new compost facility or an existing facility. In the wintertime, right now it still makes sense to send biosolids to landfill for alternative daily cover. Jason, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe you have a new contract with Redwood Landfill for the next 3 years to send biosolids there. Is that?
We're hoping to have a new five-year contract.
Five-year contract.
We contacted the general manager, Ramin, up there, and he said that he's definitely open to a five-year contract.
Okay.
So we sent our current contract there for them to send the legal department to convert it into a new five-year contract. And that's kind of in process,
okay.
My understanding is. And I asked him about the Senate Bill 1383, mm-hmm. and if he sees that affecting our biosolids, you know, daily cover disposal at the Redwood Landfill. At this time, he said he didn't see that happening. It's just a small amount that we send up there, and that they're always going to need, you know, some cover material for the landfill. And he didn't see a problem with that, you know, at this point in time. That could change.
And so yeah, at this point in time, it is the cheapest option, and it makes sense to continue to do that as long as you can. But if and when that is no longer an option, it makes sense to pursue something else. The cheapest option right now is winter land application through Synagro. But again, as I mentioned before, it also is worth continuing to just keep an eye on what the Bay Area Biosolids Coalition is doing and if they implement a new facility moving forward. Any questions on that memo before I move on? So the last memo that I'm going to talk about is switching gears from solids to biogas. And if we go back to these three energy scenarios that we've been talking about, we're really focused on this third scenario when we talk about biogas utilization. Because right now, CMSA has the existing infrastructure to achieve the first two energy scenarios. And what we're really looking at is if CMSA wants to go that final step and produce as much energy as possible on site, you'd need to look at what equipment is available to process that additional 770 kilowatts of power. So we looked at a number of alternatives to do that, just to sort of walk you through the slide. This is CMSA's existing system. You have your biogas being produced in your digester. You've got biogas treatment, and then biogas is either sent to your boiler or your cogen. All of the alternatives that we're looking at would require an expanded biogas treatment system, very similar to what you have now. For the first alternative that we looked at, it would be a new cogeneration engine housed in the same facility as your existing cogen engine, but it would produce about 850 kilowatts of power, which you could sell back to the grid to produce a little bit of revenue. Now, alternative two would require a little bit additional biogas treatment for CO2 removal. And it would produce a quality of gas that you could use at a fueling station off-site. Similarly, alternative three would require additional treatment, such that you would produce a gas that's of quality to put into a gas pipeline with PG&E. Now, both of those alternatives that we looked at involve storing gas that's produced on-site and then trucking it off-site to a different location for fueling station or pipeline injection. But the final alternative four that we looked at would really be just getting rid of that trucking option, and that would be making a new pipeline from CMSA to a receiving pipeline. But that was quickly ruled out as a possibility because you'd have to be putting a pipeline on Anderson Drive, and there's a lot of feasibility concerns and costs with that that we didn't want to move forward with there. So we really thought alternative one, two, or three would be more feasible. Delving in a little deeper into alternatives two and three, so the fueling station option and the pipeline injection option, I just wanted to put it on a map for you. You can see the blue star is Central Marin Sanitation Agency. So fueling station is located right next door at PG&E's service center, so it would be a relatively short truck trip to get there. The pipeline injection, there were two identified locations along PG&E's pipeline. Both of them are a little bit further away, but still within the ability to truck there, either the yellow site or the red site. So with those three alternatives, we had looked at a number of considerations. The first of which being some implementation issues that we saw. For either the second or the third alternative, so for the fueling station or the pipeline injection, we really need further conversations with PG&E. We've only talked with them on a very preliminary level, and we'd really need their buy-in and approval before either of those are moved forward, just to flesh out the options there. We also looked at project costs. So cogeneration is the cheapest option at around $9 million, and pipeline injection is the most expensive at around $22.5 million. There's also sort of a range of financing uncertainty. So for a cogeneration project, it's relatively straightforward to understand what your expected revenue and electricity pricing is for the next 10 to 20 years. But there's more uncertainty if you're going for an RNG, for fueling station or pipeline injection, because while there may be some credits now, you might get some more benefits from doing that now. The value of those credits and the longevity of those credits is really uncertain over the next 5 to 10 years, so it makes it hard to invest in a higher project cost. So given these financing uncertainties and project costs and some of these implementation issues, if CMSA wants to pursue one of these alternatives moving forward, we recommend looking at a more detailed study of the cogeneration system. That, does anyone have any questions? Yeah.
Outfall right away, does it cross Department of Corrections property or could close to it?
The outfall easement that we have for it?
Yeah.
I don't think so. I have two boxes of easements in my office that we're going to catalog. Well, our engineering staff is going
to
catalog.
The reason I was asking was, could a pipeline go directly to state prison property?
It probably could, but
they used to have a fuel cell cut at the top of the hill.
Yeah, that was something that, you know, we didn't look at all in terms of master planning.
Yeah.
But it's something that could be feasible.
Because they do have a power purchase program.
Okay. Yeah, that'd be something we'd really need to talk to that facility to see if they're interested.
They're the largest user in the county.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So on your cost analysis, then the $8.9 million, is that been offset at all in any way by the resale to Marin Clean Energy or PG&E?
Yeah, so these right now are just the capital project costs. These don't take into account any sort of credits or any sort of revenue generated from the electricity produced or the biogas that's sold.
Okay.
Yeah.
The two other questions. One, I think it was last month, we talked about a little bit of an ongoing study of just the actual capacity of the digester mm-hmm. with it being able to actually handle mm-hmm. an increased load like this.
Yeah.
Is that for future study to know?
Yeah, I think that does make a lot of sense. I know there's some debate among the industry right now how much you can actually load your digester with more traditional or solids, primary sludge and waste activated sludge. And so what percentage of that material versus an outside, more high-strength waste will last or prevent your digester from upsetting or causing operational challenges. So I think that does make a lot of sense to look at if you are wanting to pursue that third option where you're trying to maximize your digester capacity.
That seems like that would be number one thing
yeah.
to do.
Yeah, no, that's a really good another next step. Yeah, I should have included that.
That's actually a study. Actually, it's an objective for the series of tasks in our fiscal year 19 business plan is to do a digester solids loading study. We'd have pilot size lab digesters in our environmental laboratory, one a control, one a testing units. And I talked a little bit about this during the MC Deep Green presentation. So that's something we're going to do to figure out where that is. So we'll probably start at 30% volatile solids loading from outside sources. And then we'd have a test plan where we increase it to 35% for 2 weeks and see what happens. And if it works there, then we'll try it in the field for 2 weeks. While we in the lab, we maybe increase it to 40. And the hope is we'll get to a certain level where we know that in the lab this caused an upset of the pilot digester. Then we'd get pretty close to that, you know, possibly on site and see what happens while we're monitoring the digester very closely. Then we know what that, you know, maximum amount of volatile solids loading from liquid organic and food waste would be relative to the volatile solids loading from the wastewater solids. And then once we have that figure, we can refine then what is the actual real capacity of the digester. Alternately, you could say, well, let's just change our operational mode here. Let's just have one digester processing wastewater solids and some organics, and have a dedicated, you know, organic, you know, loading digester, kind of like what East Bay Mud has, mm-hmm. and, you know, LA County Sand and some others. So there's no wastewater solids in it, so we're not limited by that, you know, that threshold. Mm-hmm. But then under that scenario, and we don't know much about it yet, but we'd be regulated by Cal Recycle, which may be okay. But that's something that we could look into if that, you know, threshold limit is low. Mm-hmm. So that's something will happen this year, and probably by late spring we hopefully will have some more information on that.
So something going down the line is my third question is, are the regulations like with the breweries and waste producers, food waste producers, are they now being required to sort of recycle their stuff, which puts us in the position to for public home treatment work to receive it and actually have to take it, and the only alternative is to then convert it to gas and flare it off or generate electricity? Is that sort of what we're weighing out here?
Yeah, so it's interesting. There's a lot of regulations that sort of paint wastewater treatment plants as the problem because they produce a lot of biosolids that get sent to landfill and folks want to divert that. But there's also a lot of regulations that sort of see wastewater treatment plants as a solution to accept a lot more of this other type of organic feedstock. And that's, there's a little bit of a disconnect in the regulations right now about that, and that's what folks at CASA and elsewhere are looking at, trying to bridge that gap and hopefully provide some funds to do that. Does that answer your question?
Well, sort of. I mean,
okay.
if the producers of this waste are being forced
right.
to recycle it, then it
right.
has to go somewhere where a logical
right.
place for it to go.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
So therefore, we have to handle it, and then so you either burn it off,
or you use it in a different way that produces something beneficial.
Exactly.
See, right now there's regulations that are being developed under that SB 1383. Mm-hmm. They're not going to be really developed into procedures and regs until like 2021, 2022. But by 2025, you'll have that 75% diversion. So a lot of these materials that we're talking about, they won't be able to go to landfills anymore. They'll have to go to other places. And the wastewater facility, if you have anaerobic digesters and you have, you know, some way to use biogas, we're part of the solution. But the regs currently don't say that we have to receive the material and process it. Right now it's kind of optional based on our infrastructure and so forth. But there is, you know, there's conflicts between, you know, the different, you know, resource agencies, right? So you have Cal Recycle saying, hey, here's a solution, you know, wastewater plants, but then you can't flare the biogas under your air permits.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a disconnect, you know, between the different, you know, Cal EPA agencies on how to solve these problems.
Can I throw one other in there? At some point, I'm concerned that maybe at the state level, they're going to require carbon sequestration for some of these waste products from producers like mm-hmm. the breweries or the cheesemakers, and possibly not allow us to actually create gas to use as fuel. They'll want us to use 100% renewable or, you know, 100% green, I should say. Any talk of that yet?
From what I understand, so biosolids do achieve a certain amount of carbon sequestration. So if you land apply them, that does achieve some carbon sequestration benefit. So if you're taking in more of this external feedstock, producing more biosolids that then produces this carbon sequestration benefit, that's sort of the only avenue that I've seen talk of carbon sequestration. I haven't seen that it's preventing folks from sending these other alternative waste to wastewater treatment plants.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah?
Quick question. Why is the fueling station mm-hmm. collecting the gas and turning it into fuel so much more expensive?
So
it should be easier.
Well, yeah. So part of the, let me just go back to this slide really fast. So part of the difference between the first alternative and the second and third is that you do need additional gas treatment to remove carbon dioxide. So that adds additional cost. And also because you're trucking it, you do need this gas storage system because you're producing biogas and treating biogas constantly, but then it's just every now and then you're transporting it offsite. So there's this additional infrastructure that's needed.
And how do you store it? Is it liquefied natural gas or is it just...
It's compressed natural gas. Yeah.
Okay. And one thing that we it's talked about in the tech memo that's we've included here is that through the alternative 2 and 3, all of that biogas isn't converted into compressed natural gas. There's like, what's it called, straw gas or some low-grade, like 3% methane that we'd have to do something with. Mm-hmm. You know, so it can't be used as a fuel. It's not going to be accepted by, you know, a PG&E pipeline or the fueling station. So what do you do with it? We probably can't flare it because Airborne's not going to let us flare that. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of an issue with alternative 2 and 3 that we're not quite sure how we'd work through that. Maybe there's a solution, but take a lot. If we selected one of those, take a lot more study and evaluation of working with the Air Board and so forth. That's why I kind of honed in on the alternative one.
Right.
Okay. Can that low grade gas run a cogen engine?
It has.
I don't know.
It has such a low methane content that you'd need to do some refinement of that, or you'd need to. There are certain types of engines that can do that, but they're more expensive, and you have to get a specialized unit just for that small portion of that gas that's being produced as a
so it just drive like the capital costs and the life cycle costs.
Mm-hmm.
Unless the regs change, which may happen. You get the agencies talking together and trying to solve, you know, all the problems.
All right.
Well, thanks, Elizabeth.
Yeah, thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Very good.
So this is really informational. The information in these four TMs is just for planning if these future events do happen. So we have a starting point, which is good to have. Great.
Alrighty, moving on to agenda item number 6, the Board of Commissioners compensation policy.
So last month, Commissioner Gaffney, who's rotated off the CMC board, as you know, he brought up the idea of taking a closer look at the board's compensation policy, and his request was that the board should potentially consider providing the agency's daily stipend for attendance and participation at committee meetings, ad hoc committee meetings, and or standing committee meetings. So the board thought that was a fine idea to take a look at it, and you asked me to bring that policy back tonight. So that's attached to the staff report. And a little history is that this policy was first developed in 2009 by the board, and they specifically limited the what's eligible for a daily stipend would be, you know, board meetings, special emergency, or regular board meeting, attendance at conferences or training events would be eligible, as well as being a CMSA representative on a multi-jurisdictional body like the North Bay Washington Association. And then there's been questions in the past about the $100 stipend. So I spent a lot of time and looked into that. And the board's had that stipend since January of 1987. And then, as I noted in here, that in 2000, a law was passed that allowed sanitation and sanitation districts to increase the stipend up to 5% annually if they wanted to. And that law also said that once you consider or approve increasing it forward, you can also look retroactively to your last adjustment. And there's some interpretation in that. So in that scenario, CMSA looked at if we wanted to do a retroactive increase back to 2000, the maximum stipend amount could be $240. But then you could look at the table on page 2, and you see that there are several sanitary agencies that have more than $240 stipend right now. So you may ask, well, why did that happen? Well, they interpreted that law to mean that you can go back, you know, up to 5% per year back to your last adjustment prior to 2000. So some of the agencies, it was years before that, so they retroactively used the increase from that particular year to 2000 going forward to when they discussed it. And then they've, you know, some have considered it each year going forward. So you can see it ranges from $100, you know, for day service to $314. And also on the table, you see which agencies that we have, well, that I called anyways, provide a stipend for committee meetings. So anyway, so if the board wanted to modify the policy to consider providing a stipend for committee meetings, that'd be pretty easy. I just received direction to do that and bring a revised policy to back to the board at our October meeting. If you wanted to increase the stipend amount beyond $100, then that would require passing an ordinance, which can be done also pretty easily. We just have to, you know, go through the ordinance passing process, you know, notification in the paper, have a public hearing, and so forth. But anyways, so that's just, that's the staff report, and I'm here to receive any direction from the board or answer any questions on those two items that are in the policy.
A question, and I'm sorry to surprise you with this. I should have called ahead. What is this, the compensation for the Marin Municipal Water District?
Yeah. I do not know that.
Well, I know they get health benefits. So they get full
health insurance?
Yes. They get full health insurance. Oh. So they're paid approximately $35,000 to $40,000 a year in benefits and stipends.
Oh?
Yes.
And yes. Do they participate in their retirement?
Do they get chilling?
Do they participate in the retirement system there as well?
No, I do not believe they do. And I can look up the WMW.
Yeah, look up the
And by the way,
is that what you're shooting for at LMWD?
Yeah, I'm on the wrong board.
Yeah. No, you're on the right board. Thank you very much.
Wow. Okay.
That's why there's such a campaign for.
Yeah, that's why there's such a campaign for. On to your list that you. Of this list, what two or three would you say are most comparable to CMSA in complexity of their operation and size of their operation?
In terms of the treatment facility, it'd be Novato Sanitary would be closest, even though, you know, their facility is, you know, much smaller. Doesn't have the peaking factor ours does. CMSA doesn't have a collection system. Novato does have a collection system. But then CMSA, you know, provides a lot of different types of contract services that these agencies don't provide any contract services.
And you've excluded Las Colinas. Are they smaller?
They're number two. They're $252 daily stipend.
Well, no, but you're not comparable. They're not comparable.
Oh, they're very small.
Oh. And does Novato Sanitary have a co-gen?
No. Neither does Las Colinas. Las Colinas, I believe, has a very small micro treatment.
They do tertiary treatment, though.
So does Novato, yeah.
Okay.
Well, it seems like.
Can I read you this? I'm finding a little trouble with the conversation, but I can tell you what the regular board meetings. Board and other special meetings. Jack Gibson, $4,600 a year in board meetings, $5,200 in board committees, $6,600 in liaison advisements, $795 in conferences. They each got $547 for iPads. And so Gibson got $38,000, Kohler got $32,000, Russell got $39,000. Bragman got $32,000, and Armando Quintero, who gets his health care through the University of California, Modesto, where he attends all the meetings by phone, gets $7,500 a year.
Good. So Armando only gets $7,500?
That's correct.
So he's doing
no conferences.
Much less than everyone else.
Yeah. A lot less in liaison assignments, substantially less. I mean, Gibson's 6,000, he's 400. Board committees, he's 2,400. Gibson's 52. I think that's because he really does attend most of the meetings by phone. So he's in Modesto most of the time. He doesn't.
Okay.
So he's also on the state board. And I think he probably gets compensated for that too.
By the way, I want to point out that this was something I was totally opposed to, is change the compensation package. But again, I bring in the ability on this board to change my mind, and now that I'm on it, it's something.
Well, what is the history as to why the board has not done anything since 2000?
1987. This predates Al Borrow.
Yeah.
Since I've been on the board, we've discussed this probably three times, and it was brought up, and the board has said, $100 is fine. I mean, it was as simple a conversation as that.
In my recollection, it was about that long, and it was everyone just said, "Oh no, we never change it," and then we just went on.
We
never really thought about it.
Can I make a point? There's at least two board members who no longer serve on other boards. Yourself and you. I think $100 is not enough money for board members. I think board members who do their jobs, and I think all of us do. I'm new to this one, but I always put my efforts into all my board membership. Spend a lot of time on this. And I think it's time to make it a more realistic compensation policy.
Realistic is not any of these numbers, but we should be keeping up. We should be commensurate with the level of responsibility in comparison to our peers within the county.
I'm sorry. May I also say one other thing? Recently, last year, the Ross Valley Sanitary District Board eliminated our stipend for being on this board. We were bumping it up. We're not doing that anymore, and I think that makes sense from that end. It doesn't make sense from this end.
Well, it's been 31 years since we've done this. I mean, we do this three times a century. It seems like it's time. I mean, our number is we're below anything comparable. The arithmetic takes us to 240. Something in that area seems right, and we're an outlier too on not getting compensated for committees.
Can I make a motion or make a suggestion?
How did we get to this?
I go 241. I'd pay for commission meetings. I think that's reasonable. Was that the number you said going back to 2000 rather than 87?
Yes. If we went back to 87. It'd be, 5% compounding. It'd be like $450.
I think that's we're not.
And that would put us outside of the realm.
Oh, yeah.
We would be outside of the norm. I think we could probably do 240 just to make it even.
Yeah.
And that would put us right smack in the middle of the norm. We'd be a little bit higher than Nevada Sand, but. We have a more complicated operation. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, in a bigger operation and more going on and on the treatment side, especially on the source control side and the pre-treatment side, bacterial grease side, all of the regulatory aspect. We have significantly more activity than any other agency in the county.
For some time at the Ross Valley, they were also giving automatic increases every year.
And we stopped that.
That's
why we're higher.
We also used to have six-hour board meetings over there.
And one thing to know about Nevada Sand, their facility is operated by Veolia under contract. Their board doesn't really deal with treatment facility business anymore, except for just making sure the performance metrics in their contract with Veolia are met.
Violations.
Yeah.
After I read your memo today, and if there was any sort of like looking at 240, just public perception, I'm concerned about how it looks in the paper that CMSA board gives 150 or 250% raise, whatever the number is. Just sort of sensitive to that.
I hear that comment. I don't think that you may. I think when they hear that the board members put in the kind of hours and time they do and they get $100 a month, I think them. And a lot of that is a percentage. They would say the percentage, but you're getting $100 a month. Seriously? So that would be my answer.
Okay.
That is something that's going. We need to have an answer for that.
Yeah.
We need to have an answer for that because
I think the memo explains it perfectly clear. anyone can read this and say it hasn't been raised in how long?
1987.
So it all makes sense. It's sort of a no-brainer, but yet when it's just one headline, that's all the public sees. You know?
Yeah.
That's all they catch. But anyway, I just throw it out there.
Right, and we should be prepared for that, because mm-hmm. that will probably come. So there'll probably be, you should plan on an IJ report or calling. You should plan on being able to release, I mean, this is public, so to release this on the staff report.
Sure.
And to maybe, I don't know if we have anyone who writes press releases for us, but it would be nice to have a couple of talking points, you know, for the first time in 31 years, consistent with the statute. The statute justifies up to 240, and that's what we do.
I think I would alter that a little bit, Mayor Smith. I think I might say the statute actually permits us to go back to 1987 and raise it to $450, which we declined to do.
Excellent point.
The one thing I would interject there is that, to me, that's a stretch to go back to 1987. My reading of the statute says that you are well within your purview to go back to 2000, but getting back to it to 1987, I don't read it that way at all.
Okay.
All right. Well, but and then we can say, you know, in response to and the advice of counsel, we did not go back to 1987. Mm-hmm. We only went back to 2000.
And you can say that some agencies have.
And some agencies have.
Yeah.
But on the advice of counsel, we did not. I mean, this is a very modest and conservative approach. But you're right. You know, we should be seeing this in our minds on the front page of the IJ.
I would, I'm not saying I would because I'm not the board president where they normally go, but I would be perfectly comfortable taking a call from anybody in the IJ. And this is something that I can put on the front page of the IJ, not be embarrassed about.
Okay. Let's get a couple of other opinions. Dan?
I totally agree with Dean. I think if somebody gets this, they can twist this upside down and make it really look bad.
But I was just at the CASA meeting, and one of the things they discussed was if you're going to have something like this, that says we may get a call from the IJ, we better have a person designated so that if Dean gets a call from the IJ.
No, it should be Diane.
It should be the board president.
Please call.
Because she gets paid way more than I do.
That's right.
And your
I do.
Answer is, I was going to do this, but this new guy came on the board, and all of a sudden we're
One thing I would recommend is maybe whoever's going to be your spokesperson, perhaps Jason can contact CASA and see what the percentage of agencies do have a stipend that's on or about 240. Because if you can say
CASA doesn't have any kind of information about stipends, no.
I think you did a good job with your table here.
Local agencies that are within
Marin County, local.
I throw my municipal district on that. I would. 38 grand.
That's not fearful. It's just covering your bases.
Okay. Well, you know, actually, that's consistent with something that we've been doing at the City of San Rafael. We have compensation changes on two agendas, mm-hmm. so that the public has twice as many chances to see it and to comment on it. So,
exactly.
Well, we actually adopted that policy as well, if you recall.
Let's apply it to ourselves.
And
okay.
Can I make one other suggestion? Is that whoever the spokesman be, and also point out the fact that we declined 2.5% raise per year, as is allowed by this new law. So it can be 241 now with a 5% increase every year. Nobody suggested that at this table, and I'm not.
Okay.
That's what Ross Valley just stopped doing. Okay. They were going on 5% every year.
Well, let's have a motion, and I guess
I'd like to give my input first.
Oh.
I am extremely reluctant to go to 240. Mm-hmm. I don't feel like we need to be up there at the very top end, with the exception of Ross Valley. Mm-hmm. I think 200 or even 225 to match Novato would be something I could probably very comfortably accept. I think 240 is, you know, it would look like we are absolutely trying to maximize it.
Okay.
And I think that looks bad.
Okay.
Yeah, no problem. So 200, 225 would be the most that I personally would want to accept. And I would like to rewrite the
policy number two, so that the daily stipend is also applied to meetings of standing committees or ad hoc committees. Mm-hmm. I do not believe that it should be applied to anything casual like coffee with Jason or popping in to have, you know, a meeting in his office, something like that. That doesn't apply. This is standing committee meetings, ad hoc committee meetings, board of commissioner meetings, and then whatever you said was already covered, such as conferences and those kinds of things.
Well, what do you mean our monthly meetings are also?
Have you ever listened to him at those meetings with the coffee? They have to, with the mountain bike, the biking.
I would.
It's exhausting.
I would support. I would adopt what Diane just said and move that as our first reading of our proposal.
I second that.
Would you like to specify a dollar amount? Because I
said
200 to 225.
Well, I like the 225 because that matches Nevada Sanitary, and our general manager just informed us that that's the most comparable agency.
224.69.
Okay, so you are amending your motion to specify 225.
Correct.
Second that.
Okay. And I'm sorry, let me back up. Mary Beth, and you're suggesting that we advise Jason to bring it back on the next agenda.
Correct.
Consistent with standing committees and ad hoc committees.
Correct.
Right. That's yeah. Okay. All right. So we have a motion and a second. Is there any member of the public who would like to speak to this? Say none.
Just one comment?
Yes.
Are we going to then apply it to two readings at the two next successive board meetings?
Well, we are discussing it tonight, and then we will bring it back at the next meeting for a vote.
Right. It's been on the agenda once, so it will be on the agenda
twice. And it also has to go in the IJ, you said, the ordinance has to go in the IJ?
We need to, under the Sanitary District Act, we have to post a summary of the ordinance and who voted on it, I think, 5 days after the board takes action, Jack?
Summary of the ordinance would occur both before the meeting and then within 15 days of passage.
I think that's for a sanitation district.
Right.
We could use a sanitation district process, which is more close to like a county or city process, or you use a sanitary district process, which is only you pass an ordinance and you report out after the fact.
I would do both.
Do whatever's most.
Yes, okay. Do whatever's most.
So we'll do it more like the sanitation district, where we post something beforehand, then we have also the hearing, then we post afterwards with the vote.
Yeah. Okay. And I think the posting should very clearly state some of these dates, you know, like the 1987 or whatever it was.
For the first time in 31 years.
We include the whereas statements in the ordinance.
Yeah. Okay.
I'd like to just say one last thing also. There's also for people who run in like Ross Valley, you got to pay back your campaign expenses, and that's really what the stipend ends up doing.
Well, we're all appointed to here. But that's the Ross Valley side. Right.
But you also run for your own office.
But we do use our own vehicles, our own computers, and it's time and effort. All right. We have a motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? I believe that passed unanimously. Thank you.
So we'll have, on the October agenda, we'll have as the first item, we'll have the ordinance for the board to consider and the public hearing for it. And then we'll have the revised policy number two with the dollar amount inserted and the committee, you know, eligibility added to the policy. So we'll have two separate items for two different items.
I could stand out and talk about that. Sign that says, we'll attend meetings for food.
But you have to provide the food.
Yeah, that's right. You're bringing it.
Okay, guys, just get later. Let's go.
All right. Moving on, folks, to agenda item number 7, CMSA response to the Marin County Civil Grand Jury Report, Consolidation of Sanitation Districts. Jason.
Okay, so back in May, the grand jury issued, you know, a report called Consolidation of Sanitation Districts. And we're required to respond to the report, as were Santa Fe San, Ross Valley San, and San District Number 2. I brought the report to the board at the May meeting. You guys considered how we will respond to that. and you said, well, let's just wait until we can see the responses from the member agencies. So since then, Ross Valley Sanitary and Santa Fe Sanitation have both approved their responses and submitted those to the four-person grand jury. The four-person granted a 90-day extension for our response and SD2's response, which are due October 13th. So Chair First and I prepared a draft response on page 2 for the board to consider. Then we have a few options to present. One is just accept the one that we prepared, and we'll submit, or we can wordsmith it, and then you can approve that, and we'll submit. Or you could form the ad hoc committee, and we could kind of work on, you know, a response and bring that back to the board at the October meeting. And after the October meeting, we have 4 days to finalize the response and submit it to the four-person.
Okay, thank you.
Or some other action in addition to those three.
Okay. Any thoughts?
Well, I agree. I mean, first off, the idea that consolidation plan would be put in September is just crazy talk, not to mention the fact that I don't think that anybody works at LAFCO right now. So that makes no sense. And yeah, I'm fine with this answer.
Mary Beth?
Although we sometimes lapse into informality, I think that we should treat our other county agencies with respect and maybe not use informal language in the meeting. That said, I think that's a second that motion. Was that a motion?
It wasn't, but
why don't we treat that as a motion, less some of the introductory comments, and I would second it.
Okay, so any member of the public who would like to speak to this? Okay, so just to reiterate, the motion is to approve the response as drafted on page 2 of the staff report. That was a motion by Doug. Mary Beth, you seconded. Mm-hmm. Dean, did you have something to say?
Just it has a typo in the second to last line of the first paragraph. That would need to be completed and addressed before any wastewater consolidation.
Okay, thanks for finding that.
Thank you.
Correct that.
Do you mind amending your motion to...
I would amend my motion to...
correct any
minor spellings and okay. Other than that.
My second as well.
Thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, you got it.
Great.
Thank you very much. All right. We are now going to adjourn to closed session. Agenda item number 8, after which we will be reconvening.